Issues, a podcast about leadership, management, and becoming the kind of person who is excited that the local farmers market is reopening next weekend. I'm Rachel Perkins, aka Pie or Pie Bob. I'm into words, operations, cheese, and whiskey, and of course, leadership.
And I'm Kendall Miller. The recording hitherto forth is provided for informational purposes only. And though we are obviously experts, we have a podcast for fuck's sake, just like experts do, should not be construed as investment, dietary, or relationship advice. However, if you need advice on where to buy gin, we can obviously offer that.
Today on the show, we're talking with Ali Shahriari, co-founder and CTO at Reality Defender. Hi.
Welcome, Ali.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's dive in, Ali. Talk about your path to leadership. How did you become a founder in a now currently hot space, maybe before it was even currently hot? Like, how did you get to where you got?
Where did you start?
Back all the way up, as far back as far you can go.
All right. I mean, I have a kind of a traditional path, I guess. My background, you know, I studied computer science.
Just for the record, literally no one ever on this podcast has said, yeah. I have the tradition. They all start with, I have a non-traditional path. So you're the first traditional path, which I think makes you non-traditional. And sorry, I'm interrupting you before you're even starting. But
no, no problem. No problem.
Why did you decide to study computer science, and then where did you do that?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm in traditional, like, you know, I'm in tech, and I think almost every single, like, tech founder, has a computer science background. I went to UCLA. I went there for undergrad. Went there for grad. Great school.
Are you a basketball fan?
I was there when the year after. So they won the championship in 94. And then 95 was my first year there. So was that right? Or 95. So I know they're huge. Obviously, they're huge, like, sporting school, from basketball, even volleyball. Everything there was very popular. Mm-hmm. I guess even before that, I always liked computers. Like, you know, sounds very, very traditional. There's always the same story. I loved computers when I was a kid before, you know, I would do that. I would, like, disassemble, assemble, like all that stuff that you do as a kid. Mm-hmm. That's a nerdy kid. I'd have a lot of friends. it was like,
I understand. I really do.
Yeah, like that nerd with the computers. If I'm gonna go really back, my first computer that I remember. Well, I remember Pong. Do you guys remember that? Where you connect it to a TV and it's a hard device with just knobs.
The Atari.
Then I remember Atari. I had a computer. You know, my friend had a computer. I'd always go to his house to play. Didn't have a hard drive, so you would have those big floppy 5-inch floppies, not even the 3.5, the 5-inch ones. You use that to, you boot up the hard drive. You boot up the OS that way. Then we played Asteroids. Anyway, let me fast forward. So
super cool.
Yeah. So way back before even there were hard drives. So studied computer science. From there, I actually stayed at UCLA for a while. I went there for grad school, and while I was there, I was kind of officially, unofficially part of the faculty because I was, like, teaching one of the classes as a grad student, which you're not supposed to do. But so I saw my UCLA email, ali@cs.ucla.edu.
Nice.
Still use that as my personal email. I was teaching a digital design class there, like, building a CPU from scratch. From there I moved on. I had some internships along the way. I worked at Cisco Systems, and I got a job at a startup back in 2000, right during the .com. They raised a lot of money, like I think 90 million burned through it in three years and went bankrupt.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, so did all that.
What did you do at that startup?
Software development. So they were trying to build something that is kind of sort of like a hybrid AWS kind of thing, where they were building data centers everywhere, and they were able to, like, built the software on top of it to, like, push data through. So that was for a while. Then, you know, so basically, I guess, long story short, I had a lot of various jobs along the way as a software developer.
As an individual contributor, as they call it nowadays.
Yeah. I consulted at the FDIC for a while as a software developer at Unisys. I lived in DC for a while. So this is back in 2004. This is after that other company went out of business. We were working on some accounting standard. That's why I was at the FDIC. What else?
So you went west coast to east coast, just skipped right over all of the flyover country. I mean, cool. Yeah, anyways, keep going.
Did you have any great managers at that time? Anyone that you recall was especially good to you or taught you something
useful?
Yeah,
or a CTO that was a wild inspiration that led to you becoming this? Like some kind of leader that was...
Kendall wants to see himself in this podcast, so you know.
I mean, I've worked with so many great people, and obviously, you know, there's always... people that maybe are not as good, but who are some of the people? So when I did the work at FDIC, I had a great manager. We were a tiny startup and we got like a contract with FDIC. So my manager there, he lived in Seattle, was great. Like he helped me like, because I was kind of a young kid, like flying across the country to like work at the FDIC, and it's like never lived there before. So, you know, I did that a bit. You know, it was good because the manager was supporting me and like, you know, you can do this. Here's what you got to do. Like, it's going to be fun. So it's always good to like give some good advice to the young one, like pump them up and tell them how exciting it is.
You can do it.
Yeah. And, you know, like, yeah, it was fun. I really enjoyed my time there. From there, I started a women's fashion company. We sold stuff to Nordstrom's and to Tiller.
Oh, yeah. How did that happen? Accounting software.
Tech. Women's fashion.
Are you a fashion fan?
Yeah. You just learned sewing? Because Rachel's a sewer.
I love to sew, but I'm not fashionable at all.
Yeah. From 2005 to 12, we had me and a friend of mine. We were always doing tech, and we were like, let's try something different, something that we kind of have a little passion about, and, you know, we're not experts in, but we think we can, like, do some cool stuff. So both of us wanted to, like, start a fashion company. So we did.
But women's fashion. Like, you're not, for the record, Ali is not a woman. And so I think that's obvious, but
sure.
Just to make clear.
It was a men's, the first two collections were men's and women's. And then we quickly realized we don't have the money and the resources to like do both. And so it was women's, but it did well. It started to like get a lot of traction. Again, we were in Nordstrom's for several seasons, Dillard's. We were in some boutiques. We had a high-end brand and a couple like contemporary brands. But we did that, start to make money and like become a little bit profitable. But
and this was your first leadership role? Like you were the co-founder of this company?
Yeah, I was a co-founder. Was there any leadership role before that? No, that was my, I became a senior software developer consultant when I was doing the FDIC stuff. Mm-hmm. But
you had never had a direct report before?
No.
Founder, CEO, boom, yeah. That's it.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that it would be a fashion company, but you can probably look up photos of me on the runway and like with Paula Abdul and stuff like that. Like if you Google.
That's awesome.
What was the name of the brand?
It's called Thrive, THRIVE.
Okay. So, and is it still around?
Very cool.
No, we killed it in 2012. We started to lose money. And like at that point, we were also me and my business partner at the time, were very focused on tech. We're like, okay. We just
done with fashion.
Yeah, I mean, we hired people. We had a factory in downtown LA. We had seamstresses. We had pattern makers. Fabric we were sourcing some of it in Asia.
So that's a lot of learning on the job, right? Because like you hadn't done that sort of work before.
No.
So you had staff reporting to you. Did you like? Try to learn anything about becoming a leader at that point, or did you just I know what I'm doing? Did you read any books or take any classes or try to get training somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I think people say this person is a natural born leader. I think sure some people can be that way, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't like still like read a couple of books and and steady, because you'll still make some stupid mistakes. So
yeah, I might learn something.
Yeah.
Do you have good stupid mistake stories?
Too many.
Yeah. I mean, was there any especially rough time at this fashion startup? Like when you first started hiring people, did you learn something, you know, hard lesson to learn there? Because wow, directly from individual contributor to I am the boss of everyone. That's a big jump.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing has always been having to, like, let people go. That's always been hard. Like, I can't imagine anything harder, especially, it doesn't matter if they're doing a good job or a bad job. It's just always a hard conversation. So
definitely.
That was probably the hardest thing. And I had to do that.
Well, if you ever... Yeah, if you
it
ever,
always gives me a stomach upset.
Yeah, if it ever doesn't, you're probably doing it wrong. But somebody did... Care. I was in a conversation just the other day where somebody said... worse than letting people go is having somebody that you work with pass away, and then everybody's just an emotional disaster trying to support each other, leaning on each other, and, you know, people crying in one-on-ones and, you know, like that kind of thing, which I can imagine but haven't been through. So hope to not have to go through.
It is. Well, so it's pretty rough.
So keep going. So how big does the fashion company get? Is it you and the co-founder most of the time? Do you grow to 60 people? How big does it get? And then what comes next?
Big were we? We were probably about 20 people. Like I said, we had a factory. We had in-house, like, seamstresses, pattern makers. Some things we did in-house. Some things we produced in China. That went on for a while, and, you know, eventually it got profitable. But then, like, I think the market was starting to turn, and we had to shut it down. We tried to, like, look at maybe, like, selling it, but we just kind of got tired of it, and we were, like, very focused. At the time, my friend also started another company. And that was called Originate, and that's where I eventually joined that as, I don't know, the 10th person there. That company grew, still around. But I went, that's where I really became the, like, had people directing to me. I started there as, like, director of engineering and went up to VP. I think we were, like, 30 people or something. I've always been in small companies, even when I was, like, consulting at Unisys or FDIC, like, you know, I was part of a small startup. I love working at startups. It's just, for me personally, is more fun. There's just so much happening, and you can kind of learn a lot more, and things move faster. I prefer
it's
that.
It's more flexible sometimes too, right?
So how'd you end up at Reality Defender? How'd you end up deciding to start? And just real quick, my understanding of this is Reality Defender helps differentiate between what's AI generated and what's not, right? So the people can know what's reality, which is, like, a thing we're running into with fake Biden calling people. I mean, it's an interesting space right now, in particular, as AI is blowing up. But you start this before ChatGPT comes on the scene and blows everybody's socks off. So how did you end up in this space? It was prescient timing, you know, like give a little bit of background there.
Yeah, for sure. So let's fast forward to Reality Defender. There was a company, so after originally I joined something called AI Foundation, another company called AI Foundation.
What year is that?
2019, I joined AI Foundation. So 2019, and that company was working on digital twins, you know what a digital twin is now. Back then I had to explain it, but now you know what it is. Over there, I came in as a head of product and software. I was doing both. I was doing, like, product and software development. But they had worked on how do you make a digital twin, right? Like, do you do, like, a cartoon? Do you do, like, a 3D rendered graphic?
Yeah. Do you scan a person?
Yeah. So then there were, like, these research paper we were looking at, and, like, oh, you can take someone's face and put it on a video, and you can kind of blend it in, and you can actually,
like, elf Christmas cards,
right? But it looked like a video, a real person, but someone else's face. So kind of like that led us to realize, hey, we bet, like, in a few years, like, this will be very easy to make. You can just download an app and make whatever. And so that's where a little side project came out, a little tiny project called Reality Defender. And we're like, let's try to detect these things. and
deepfakes.
It was
so this is even before people are using the word deepfake, probably. I mean, 2019, yes. I don't know, maybe deepfakes around by maybe. Then I can't remember when it comes onto the scene.
I don't think that was around back then.
Okay,
it's like we're talking about like January 2019 too, not like
okay.
So
when people had more time on their hands the following year.
Yeah, so that little project was just like, you know, we built a little Chrome plugin. I was managing that project. It was me and like a couple guys, just like a little side project. Fast forward like a year, that became a nonprofit. We spun it out. And we actually got some funding from Microsoft. They have something called Defending Democracy. So they were actually one of our first customers. And we actually spun up a website called rd2020.org. And we were thinking possibly deepfakes might become a problem for the election 2020. And they weren't. I don't think anything happened. I think we were a little early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... yeah, so but we were like, this stuff is going to become a problem. So, and from there, around 2021, I think, seed fund, we switched to a regular corporate company, but we're still like very mission driven.
So you beat OpenAI in the nonprofit to for-profit switch. I mean, man, this is like, you were a leader in this industry, man.
We're still heavily mission driven, but really, think what we're doing is important. People need it, and just to step back, we love AI, we love all this cool technology coming out, we're so excited about it. What we want to do is just make sure nobody is misusing all these tools, and you know, there's a lot of damage that can be done now.
Yeah. And so what does the organization look like now? I mean, are you 20 people? Are you 50 people? How big is it? What are your leaders? Like, talk about the actual leadership challenges that you're dealing with now this phase. Like, and especially because I assume it's booming now. It's the one place that can still raise money. So you're probably doing just fine financially. I don't know. But like, just talk about what it's like to actually be leading in this space.
Yeah. We are leading in the space. I'm pretty sure we're the first that started detection. I don't know anyone else.
No, I mean your problems as a leader, not the product's problems as a leader. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah, so the company now, so we did a Series A. We announced it, I think we raised 15, 16, something like that. Last year, October, I think we announced it. And we're 32 people. The company is mostly, it's very research heavy. Like we have, I don't know how many PhDs we have. I've lost count. Mm-hmm. My co-founders, I have two co-founders. One of them is our CEO. He's like former Google, Goldman Sachs. He's the one that does all the amazing job of like, you know, doing the business stuff, working on getting the revenue, helping us, you know, raise money. My other co-founder, his background is AI. He has his PhD from Harvard and basically mm-hmm. AI. So
Wimps.
I was going to say, and you're the slacker of the group. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much, yeah.
Aw. Well, how did you get to, like, how did you get involved with them? And then how did you choose, decide to build the company? How big was it when you joined?
How much hiring have you been involved in? Right, so I was at the beginning. It was a little project, side project with mm-hmm. me and a couple guys. One of them still with us. So from there, as it grew, we I already knew Gaurav, because my other co-founder, because he was at AI Foundation. Then as we were like, let's spin this thing out into like something more real, concrete, we found Ben, and Ben joined, who's our CEO. And from there, yeah, we're 30 people now. I'm the CTO, and I also like head all things tech engineering. You know, I got to make sure this product works, which it does, and it scales and all that stuff. The team is, as I said, is very research heavy. It's mostly engineers and PhDs doing like research on how to detect this stuff. And then a small percentage is actually like biz dev, ops, finance, you know, so mm-hmm. that's kind of the structure right now.
And 32, okay. I mean, that's when you start making some of the changes from startups startup generalists to some specialists. Are you going through that change now? I mean, for some companies, it's more like 40 when that starts to happen. Are you dealing with that, or are you still feeling very startup-y and people can kind of go everywhere and do everything?
You mean in terms of product that we're building,
no,
or in terms of
the individuals,
in.
You know,
oh,
they do a bunch of different things, maybe, you know, less so for engineers, but more for the infrastructure of the company people.
I think we also still wear many hats, but, not as many as we used to.
So how do you like look for people to work at this company? Are you actively hiring right now?
And we are.
Do you have a particular process that you use for hiring and onboarding people?
Yeah, we're definitely hiring. So if anyone listening to this, please go to our website and look under the
All right,
careers
we'll
section.
Post that. We'll
yeah,
post
so
that.
We're hiring. Yeah,
jobs,
so
jobs.
Yes. So yeah, I mean it's a pretty standard. Well, first of all, it's not standard. Like, it is standard, but not, like, we're very picky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a take-home exam, then there's more technical stuff during the interview. You know, we really want to make sure we get the right type of, you know, the right fit for the position. So we're very picky.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the process is, you know, you apply through our website or through LinkedIn or any place where, you know, is posted. We have a tool that posts it in multiple places.
Mm-hmm.
One of those like recruiting tools. We also work with a recruiting company. So, yeah, you know, once you see it, you post, you submit your application, and we'll have like a screening call from there. Depending on the position, it might be like depending on the type of position, there's different kind of paths, right? Like, but in general, everyone does like a screening call. Then there might be a take home, and then you talk to. Maybe you have two or three interviews, and then that's it.
What do you personally do differently or unique in this process?
Myself personally?
What role are you playing in the hiring process?
Yeah.
Oh,
are you involved in most of the hiring?
Absolutely,
still?
Yeah.
Because it's small, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the founders still interview every single person we hire.
Okay.
I think we're still small enough. And early, like, or we're still small enough where it's important, you know. I mean, it's always important, but at some point we can't, you know, if we grow to, once we grow bigger than a certain amount of people, we
mm-hmm.
probably
yeah,
can't
you
interview
have to
everybody.
Scale it. Right.
Yeah.
Totally.
But right now we're involved. Like, we definitely interview everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would you say you have a particular philosophy around management, around leadership, around, you know, working with people who report to you?
Yeah, I learned this from another founder, but like his quote, I forgot what it was exactly, but I really like it, is like, you know, at the bare minimum, what you need to do is at least like set something to measure is good for everyone. So like, you know, whether it's KPIs or OKRs or whatever it is, like so people that report to me, they have like specific kind of goals for the quarter that are very highly aligned with, you know, everything we're doing with the company mission and goals and roadmap, right? So,
mm-hmm.
they have to be measurable things where I can, and I don't like set it, I have them come up with it. And then I'm like, okay,
that
looks like
good,
a good
yeah.
goal. Are you sure about these numbers? Like, what was the baseline before? Like, is it doable to go from 25% to 90%? That's like a big jump. Do you want to think about it and come back? So I really let them think about these things and set the goals. And then from there, I have them do the same with their team. So I have like, because, you know, my engineering team, my data engineering team, they all have like people reporting to them. So they do the same thing. And but yeah, so I think the bare minimum is just like, says something you can
measure.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about that. I immediately think of Goodhart's law, you know, which is as soon as a measure becomes a target, it ceases to
yeah.
be a good measure.
Yeah.
Is that at play?
Have
I mean,
you
if,
seen that happen? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm trying to think of what other leadership philosophies there are. Having things to measure isn't inherently evil. I'm just curious, like, do you run into that problem? Do you run into Goodhart's law regularly as a result of this?
Right, Dilbert fans, I have just authored myself a new minivan. The, you know, this is how many your measurement is, like, how many bugs you find. Well, I just, you know, found a billion bugs that I wrote myself, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, I think we're too small and we're very mission driven, and that hasn't happened right now yet, right? But I definitely, that has come up, and also like every quarter, you know, the things change. It's not the same thing, right? But I mean, there are certain things that. Okay, so like, what's a good example? A good example would be like we have a data engineering team, and they generate data and give it to the AI team, right? And so like,
oh, like training sets.
Yeah. So the AI mm-hmm. team would be like, this quarter we need the following specification. They create specs, and they're like, we need the following specs, right? So like, maybe there's 10 of them. So we can have a goal like, you know, how many of these can we deliver on time, and was approved by the AI team, and it has what they need, right? So like, that can be like a good one. Like, you know, let's set mm-hmm. a number here. Last quarter we did X. Maybe this quarter let's try to do Y, right? Like
X plus 10 or something. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
And Kendall, you've been wanting to ask a question. Go ahead.
Well, I've got a lot of questions about this. I mean, Ollie, you're. It feels almost like you fell into this the way that you're describing it, right? Like this is a thing that comes up at this other company. You build this sort of side project. It's a plugin for Chrome. It turns into a company. You bring on two other co-founders. Now you're along for the ride. The company's grown. It's succeeded wildly. Yes, you're in this AI space. And we're trying real hard to probe at like, what's the shit that makes you different and unique? So I guess I want to start
why
with
that.
Why
are you good at this?
Yeah, why are you any good at this? And then I have other questions around from there.
Yeah.
No pressure.
So one thing I want to say is I loved the idea as soon as like it came up. Like it was like, oh, the light went up. I was like, this is what I wanted. So while I was at AI Foundation, I was the most excited about this. So I was doing a lot of things, but this was the thing that I like kept alive while I was there. So it definitely like, it kind of came by accident. Hey, we're doing digital twins. And then like, well, maybe we should detect these things. And then,
what if people don't want that? Yeah.
Right. Well, but I saw this. I was like, this will be a problem. Like I loved it. And I was like, this is what I want to do. Like,
yeah.
So. You had the
a lot of people who are making products don't think about the way it can be abused. So I'm really glad that, you know, you're in this thinking about that.
The other thing I want to add is like, I knew there was no market. Like I like to joke that we had a product before there was a product market fit. Like, you know, the product market fit is here now. Like, but I knew this was going to be a problem. So like, I loved it. Like, so.
Yeah, you can work on that.
And,
yeah.
Well, okay. So then now at Reality Defender, you're in charge of all of engineering. Do you manage all the people as well, or do you set the technical direction and someone else manages the people?
We've created a little bit of hierarchy now that we're getting bigger, right? So I was managing everyone. Now I have head of data engineering. I have a head of engineering. So like, that's,
but they all report up through those people to you. You're still in charge of the engineering organization. Okay.
Yes.
And are there unique challenges to being a leader in the AI space? I mean, in the same way, right now, if you're not in the AI space and you're selling B2B SaaS infrastructure, you have unique challenges in that the market fell out from under that. Money's no longer free. Hiring people's super easy. I mean, it's like it's a completely different world. So what's unique about being in the AI space?
And the kind of people that work, right? You said you have a lot of PhDs.
Yeah.
Maybe some of them are right out of grad school and they don't, you know, they're not accustomed to being managed in the way that
assholes.
They might need to be. Yeah. 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 I've just been hearing about that a lot recently. Smart assholes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, everyone's very respected at the company. So that's good. All right. So what are our unique challenges? So first, we're not actually an AI company. We are a cybersecurity company. So
okay.
Like, in terms of the challenges, there's definitely a very, like, the biggest challenge is this. It's like keeping, we're in an arms race, what we're doing. It's like, there's many words for cat and mouse, arms race, right? Like, one way I like to kind of say is we're like some people have mentioned, we're kind of like a antivirus company in some ways, mm-hmm. right? So we're detecting deepfakes. They were called, now they're called generative AI. So we detect video, image, audio, for audio, even like phone calls. So like we just integrated with one of the largest banks in America. And when people make phone calls, it'll go through our system to make sure it's not a deepfake. because there's been a lot of examples of that actually happening where they transfer money out. We also detect texts like ChatGPT. So we detect all those. The problem is 3 months from now, there's a whole bunch of new like generation techniques, and our models might not detect them, right? Mm-hmm. So that the challenge is to keep up, and that's going to be basically a forever challenge. And so, but how do we do that?
That's on the product side. So yeah, what's the people implication of that?
Is that so why the people have to remain trained, PhDs? Right? They have to learn as they go. Yeah, they want to be aware of new information. Is that one of the big challenges that you have for your people?
Exactly. So we have to be ahead of the curve. We have to know what's being like, what's the next research paper that's coming out that's like a new way of generating, like doing generative AI. And okay, like usually those would lead to like maybe some open source GitHub repo. And I'm like, okay, well, let's go look at this and play with it. And do we detect it already or not? If we don't, we have to like generate data and basically make sure the model's detected. We're also like careful, like because we look at what's the most common like techniques right now, which ones is a bad actor most likely to use, and then we make sure we're very robust against those. So the challenge is making sure, so we have like a product team now, and their job, I used to be head of product here, now we have a product person. Their job is to like constantly scan, okay, what's the latest generation technique?
Look ahead.
What's everybody using? What's like going viral, right? Okay, do we detect those? Or what's coming up next, right? So they're constantly asking these questions. The AI team is constantly looking, okay, how do we, every month we have new updated models. We have like 10 detection models. So we use AI to detect the AI. And so every month, like these models are being updated. And so like their job is to like, okay, we gotta like adjust our models to detect this one. Then there's the data engineering team. Every month they're like, okay, we gotta like generate more data. Right. And so they can train it. Then there's a product team that has all these different products that we're like spinning out and integrating with the banks and you know, news media companies. Like, so it's kind of like they're kind of set, and it's becoming a nice system where everything's running well and everyone knows what they have to do to keep up. So does that answer the question?
I would like to sort of pivot a little bit and talk a bit more about, especially in the light of the situation when you went from being an individual contributor to a leader at the top of a company and didn't really go in between. Like, I don't know that you've ever been a mid-level manager. Okay.
Yeah. So
do you want to talk about that a little bit or go on to the, so I want to talk a bit about your relationship to authority, because that's what this podcast is about, is whether you're, how you feel about having authority over other people, like, right, you're a leader of an organization now, and you have power over other people and their livelihood and what they do every day. And how do you feel about that? And how do you feel about when people have authority over you? You know, is it hard for you to take orders from someone? How do you, what makes it work for you? So let's start with the first half. You're the boss of a bunch of people. How do you feel about that?
I haven't thought about it that way too much. I think of it as like, we are on a mission, which is to prevent like AI to be abused. You know, like that's, I feel like everyone here, you know, obviously they all work for Reality Defender, but I feel like they're also like my friends, but everything's still strictly very, very like, you know, business, you know, oriented. But like, I don't think of like, okay, this person is below me or under me or above me, right? Like, it's like, we have a mission. Okay, data team is doing this, engineering team is doing this, AI team is doing this, let's build, right? I haven't really sat down and been like, oh my God, these people report to me and like, I can fire them or something, or like, you know,
it's a collaborative, your relationship to authority is tied to the fact that there's a collaborative, we're all swimming in the same direction and you feel like you're there to support them, or like there just isn't a, there just isn't a hierarchy. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there is a hierarchy. Like you know, I am the CTO, people report to me. They have KPIs, you know, I make sure like, I help them with their KPIs, make sure they stay on target. But yeah, what you said is like, we're all swimming as, what did you say? Like we're on a mission here. The mission is protecting people, and that's how I see it. And that's how everyone sees it. So
yeah. And is that always how you've worked with folks who are your bosses? Is it's been mission driven and you didn't really think about the fact that they were in charge of you? Like, you had a great experience with that first boss that you described, and they were very supportive of you and your travels across the country to do something new.
Yeah.
Have you had more relationships like that with bosses, or has it been less overtly supportive?
It's been always supportive. I guess maybe I've been lucky. My relationships with people that report to me have always been more like, you know, definitely like someone that's helping me and I'm helping them and they're guiding me. And, you know, so it's been more collaborative. And just to answer the other question, when I was at Originate, I came in, I was a senior software developer. So I came in as like director level, because I had been writing software for many years. I was a consultant. I was at the FDIC and all that. So I started there as a senior software developer, worked my way up slowly to VP. So that's where I grew and like got more and more leadership experience.
Okay. You want to talk a little bit more about that? What was the process like of becoming a leader there?
I was there for 10 years. So it was basically watching that little company grow. Yeah. It was watching it slowly grow, hire more people, and just as we got more people, I was able to just grow in that leadership position. So it was kind of very natural.
Yeah. What was the growth?
What do you think go ahead. We will interrupt each other and you constantly. We should have told you that beforehand. that again, Kendall. Sorry.
Yeah, what was the growth like? You said 10 years you watched it grow. I mean, did it grow from 2 to 50? Did it grow from 20 to 500? What was that like?
It never went to 500. I think, I'm sure I remember, it went from like 5. I was like one of the first few people there to, I think, 30, I said. I think it was 30. It might have been more. We started to have offices around the country. My point is like, it was good to learn on that. Yeah, it was distributed. Yeah. And it was just kind of good to learn.
But in Reality Defender, you've already grown faster than that, and there's a growth trajectory that looks like it could continue faster than that. Are you worried about getting out over your
skis?
Is
that terrifying?
I'm so excited about Reality Defender. Like, you know, out of every place I've worked in the past, like, I really love this company the most. Not just because I'm a co-founder and CTO.
Because you're a co-founder. It's your baby. Of course you care about it more.
It's our baby, like, yeah, me and my two co-founders, and but I really, really like the mission. I love the mission. Like, it's something that I keep saying, we're very mission driven. Like, we really like want to.
Oh, it's a very good mission. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's super critical to what's going on right now. It is. It's very important, and I'm glad that someone's working on this problem that's had a couple of years to get going on it. So Kendall, you're
well, yeah, and now that you're talking about peak excitement at work, I'm curious, what is life like outside of work? Do you have family? Do you have hobbies? Is it all Reality Defender all the time? You go home and you hire, you wake up and you LLM and you have lunch and you kick ass. I don't know. I'm trying, but what else? Yeah.
I think it's hard for a founder, especially where we are right now and like AI and what my company is doing, to have any social life. I can tell you like a little bit, like in the past, like, I mean, yes, so I moved to New York recently because we just started Series A. I came here and we have an office here. So I'm doing a lot of just like, I'm married to the job a little bit, but I am married, and my wife would kill me if she heard, like, I'm married to the job.
Better not tell her about this podcast.
Your mistress, the job.
That's common.
Yeah, I guess sometimes there's competition between, like, hey, you're working too much, like, stop working. Right? So, like, that happens, I think, with any founder. I guess outside of work, I love to sail. I've been sailing since 2000. So, like, I have my skipper's license and sailed everywhere.
Do you have a boat? Or do you charter boats and you're sitting small? Yeah,
that would be a waste of time right now, right?
What I learned very early was like this joke where like the happiest day, do you guys know this one? The happiest day in a boat owner's life is the day they buy the boat and the day they sell it.
The boat.
Yeah.
And in between, it is a hole in the water into which you throw money, right?
Yeah, things keep breaking, yeah.
Yeah, so. Yep. Kendall is beginning to learn this, I think. You said you were going to come out here and go sailing.
I took a bunch of sailing lessons in Portugal last year, yeah. So, I mean, I'm a fan. I love it, too. I understand the draw, but I think I talked to somebody who said you need to spend at least 10 weeks on the boat every year, full-time, before
it pays off
owning one.
Yeah.
Cool. Easy, it's just a charter, like fly somewhere and charter for a week and give it back when you're done, and that's it.
So where's your favorite place to sail, or the favorite place you've ever sailed?
I've sailed all over, like, but I'll tell you, so I've sailed in in the Mediterranean a bunch of times. I've sailed, like, in Thailand. I've sailed in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. But my most interesting one was I sailed once from Panama to Costa Rica, and we stopped by what they call the Perles Islands, I think, where they film Survivor. But that one was interesting because we hit a huge storm. So that's the most memorable one. It was like 4 a.m. and I'm out on deck, and like you can see the waves, just like it was a sailboat, right? And so like the wave, it was a big sailboat, it was like 70-footer, but still like the waves like hitting, going up and down, and just water splashing in, and it's like 4 a.m. I'm like, what the hell am I doing here?
So that was the most memorable. At that point, so
yeah,
that you don't
get
knocked
out.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we were definitely clipped in. Yes.
And what was I going to ask about that? Have you ever sailed the Pacific Northwest? It's a dream of mine to sail up by where
that's
Rachel
where I
lives.
Live. Yeah.
What area is that?
Like Seattle, all the way up to Vancouver, and
I have sailed in Seattle. Yes, I've sailed in Seattle, but that was a day sail. I did. And it started raining immediately.
Of course. Yeah, you got to be hardy to sail out here year round. It's true. So you said you have your skipper, your captain's license. That's another place where you might become a leader. Like, were you the boss of the boat when that storm happened? And how did you? Did you have to tell people what to do, or was someone else in charge?
Yeah, on that boat I wasn't, but I would say like 70% of my sails, 75%, I'm the skipper. So yeah, I tell people like what to do and how to like
crank that crank. Yeah. Get out of the way. Duck.
But some people become really crazy when, like, no, I'm very chill, like, when I'm the skipper.
That's good.
Like, I tell people what to do.
You gotta
with, like,
be chill
a nice
when
boat.
It's an emergency. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So you're saying right now
before you move on, I just want to say when I was learning to sail, the guy that I was learning with was so calm. And my son he's 13, so he would have been 12 at the time, is bringing the boat in to port and not turning it quite right. And the guy is just calmly, more to the left, more to the left. And I'm like, dude, this is a $160,000 mistake that he's about to make, and you are chill as a cucumber. Like, I could not believe that he was, and it was totally fine, and my son totally did it. The guy was just like, a little more. That's not quite enough. A little more to the left. And I'm just like,
gotta learn
shit,
that
I'm
dude.
Flipping out here. Yeah, anyways.
Everybody.
Okay, go ahead, Rachel. Sorry.
So I was going to ask. No, you completely derailed me. So you're you're now, you know, you're in the midst of a massive growth situation. You've got not a lot of time for your personal life and home and stuff. But how has becoming leader affected your personal life? Like, when you started to learn how to manage people, did that change the way that you interacted with other people around you, your friends, your family, that kind of stuff? Do you view those things as having some parallels?
I think a little bit, maybe not like on purpose, but subconsciously you change, right? Like, as you're starting to like grow as an individual in general, right? But like, yeah, as I have people, as I'm in a leadership position, generally, like, yeah, I think that definitely rubs off in personal life as well. Like, and not in a good or bad way, just in general, like, you know, you evolve as a person. So I can't like point to a specific example, but I think
like having one-on-ones with your partner,
no,
scheduling you for your quarterly goals.
Yeah, we're not doing that.
I don't know. In this particular situation, I see you walking into your house and walking up to your spouse and like grabbing their face and being like, "Are you real? Damn it, speak."
That's a little different.
I mean,
We've had issues where we interviewed someone. It was a Zoom call, and it was an interview, and halfway through, they completely changed. Like, like they were a completely different person. So they fooled us because we weren't running like a defect detector on the Zoom call. But that was like,
do you do that now?
We're starting.
Because I gotta wonder if there's people out there who are like, I wanna bring these people down a notch. Let's see if I can get a job without being an actual person, kind of thing.
Well, that was the whole point. They were trying to impress us with that, and we were very impressed. But it also kind of proved our point, like things that are happening, right?
So we're did you hire that person?
We actually did not. They were close, but it just wasn't the right match at the end.
Didn't work out for them.
But we love them and we wish them the best. But yeah,
that's some chutzpah right there. Bringing the problem right to the interview.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Okay. I think we have to wrap it up. I think that's what Kendall's about to say.
Yep. For time's sake, we should wrap up.
So we want to make sure people can reach you on the internet. I know that I have your LinkedIn, and then you have provided me with your Twitter. Let's see. Okay, I will post that in the show notes. Is there anything else you would like to tell us about how to reach you?
Yeah, any other way to reach you before?
I'm always happy. I mentioned I have my personal email, ali@cs.ucla.edu, and then my work is ali@realdefender.com. And yeah, I can be reached.
It's .com. Yeah, not AI.
And as
AI.
We let you out, give us a recommendation. An LLM to use, a book to read, a movie to watch. It can be anything. Any recommendation. What's something you've consumed or used lately that you were impressed with?
I don't know. I can't think of anything. The first thing that pops in my head, I guess, maybe watch Terminator 2, because not because the machines are taking over, but there's a scene that just keeps popping in my head. I'm like, oh, that was the first deepfake audio. Arnold Schwarzenegger calls the kid's house, but speaks in the kid's voice. Mm-hmm. And the other end is the other robot speaking in the mom's voice, and they're both doing deepfake audio. And I was like, wow, that was like definitely something to think about. It's like this, we were talking about 1991. So this stuff, people had the imagination, and then that was it's not the killing machines, but the deepfake
stuff.
Sci-fi
always leads the way. Yeah. And
I always think of sneakers.
Someday we're going to be on Arrakis and eating spice melange. Anyways. Thanks so much for joining us, Ali. We will
It's been good to chat with you.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you guys. Thank you.